Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting new books. And this week I'm very happy to say we have Wolfgang G. Schwanitz on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, co-authored with the late Barry Rubin, Nazis, Islamist, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. As I told Wolfgang in the pre-interview, this book was something of a revelation to me. I'm not a student of Middle Eastern history, but I am a student of European history, and I did not know the extent to which we'll be talking about several individuals, but I did not know the extent to which the Germans were involved in Middle Eastern affairs, basically between or beginning with World War I and then, well, it's ongoing through World War II. So I learned quite a bit from this book, and I imagine you will too. The book is somewhat controversial, I imagine. I know I've read a little bit on the web about some of the issues that it addresses, and it is something that, as I say, of ongoing, I don't know if debate is the right word, but people are very interested in the topic. So first let me say, Wolfgang, thank you very much for being on the show.
You're welcome.
All right. Could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I was born in 1955 in East Germany, and my parents worked as diplomats in the Middle East. So they took me and my two brothers to the Middle East, to Egypt, to Cairo, where we spent 5 years. And later then, in 1965, we returned to Cairo in the same position, and I was a boy of, say, 10 years as the War of June 1967 occurred. I was just in my school on the outskirts of Cairo, and all of a sudden we were rushed into buses and so on, and we saw Israeli jets over Cairo, and this war made a big impression on me. Since ever I wanted to know more on the Middle East, and so I went to study the subject for 5 years at Leipzig University, a great institution with a long tradition. And so I became an Arabist and economist after studying the Middle East. And since ever, I worked in research on the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Now, could you tell us why you wrote this particular book, Nazis, Islamists, and the Making of the Modern Middle East, with Barry Rubin?
Yes, I discovered early on there is a lack in our knowledge on the relations between Middle Eastern countries and Germany. And so I concentrated or focused on this topic since 3 decades. And after the German unification, it was possible also to access other archives. Since Germany was divided, the archives were divided as well. So, but with the unification, we were able to get a more complete picture. And I continued this research in the United States. And in the United States was a similar process of releasing records of World War II and thereafter. And so I looked at the same topics and issues from other sites, from more neutral sites, say, like the United States. And that's why we wrote this book. We met in 2007 at the Middle East Forum of Philadelphia, and we agreed to write jointly this book, because we were both of the opinion that it's really necessary to find out what really happened in World War I, in World War II, in the Cold War, and in the global era.
Mm-hmm.
And you perhaps know that historians usually work just on one era, let's say World War I or World War II or Cold War and so on. We agreed, Barry and I, that it's necessary to overcome this work on just a narrow field and offer a broader vision on what might have or has happened mm-hmm. in this process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if I could summarize that one of the themes or threads of the book, I mean, essentially it's a genealogy of really almost a single idea and a prejudice, and that single idea is an Islamic or Arab jihad against the Western powers, and an attempt to remove the Jews from the Middle East. Those are two threads that run throughout the book, all the eras.
Right.
Yes.
Yes.
So I was going to say, let's begin talking about the origins of this idea that is an attempt to expel the Western imperialists, if we can call them that, the British and the French, and then this anti-Semitism. I think that it wouldn't do injustice to your book to say that it begins with a fellow named Max von Oppenheim.
Right. Western powers discovered the world, and so they conquered different areas, including in the Middle East, especially France and the British Empire and so on. And the Germans were somehow latecomers to the scene, to the world theater. So they didn't build empires, and they had no colonies in the Middle East. After 1871, there was a united Germany, and they were very successful to advance and to have economic and cultural expansion to the Middle East. And one key figure was Max von Oppenheim. He was of Jewish descent, but actually he was a Christian. He was born into a Jewish family. And he was a traveler to the Middle East, and in 1893 and 1894, he made his big journey from the Mediterranean to the Gulf. It's the title of his book. And he discovered people and countries and so on. There he watched a stiff resistance to Western values, ideas, concepts. And remember, there was the Mahdi movement in Sudan, and the Mahdi was able to regain the Sudan. And they had for a dozen of years an Islamic country as empty of foreigners. So this was a model, and Max von Oppenheim got the idea, when the Germans don't possess colonies in the Middle East, they could use these resistant movements against the other empire builders, so to stab them in their colonial back. And this was a basic idea, and he discovered a lot of, as he calls them, anti-Christian brotherhoods. The Mahdiya, the Sanusiya, the Ikhwaniya, and so on. And they said, well, they don't have parties, they don't have parliaments, but they have these brotherhoods, and we can use the brotherhoods as platforms to jihadize Islam. We need to prepare them accordingly. And this was the basic idea, and the Kaiser used this idea in 1896. He sent a message to Tsar Nicholas, and he said the following: Berlin's empire-building neighbors will squash Germany that has no colonies in the Middle East. And he continues to the Tsar, from there they get materials, markets, and soldiers to use them against her. A friend of his met a Muslim prophet in Baghdad. The friend was Max von Oppenheim, of the Al-Qadiriyya Brotherhood, so mighty in India that a signal by Wilhelm would spark a revolt. Losing the colony by an Islamist revolt reduces Britain to a third rank power. And this way the genie got out of the bottle. This was Wilhelm's message to the Tsar. And since ever, they worked and expanded this idea, and they met Islamists, and there was already a broad Islamist movement in the Middle East, let's say, since 1856. Mm-hmm. And there was a feeling eventually there will be an all-out war in Europe. And we, as Germans, can use those Islamists to incite revolts in the back, so the powers need more troops to keep them down, and the troops can't work or fight against the Germans in Europe. This was the basic idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, that war came in 1914, and what role did the or what did the Germans attempt to do to foment this jihad against the Western powers?
First of all, they had Max von Oppenheim developed a plan how to do it. He wrote on 136 pages how to use the Muslim Brotherhoods. And before this, he described to the Kaiser how you can use Islamism. And he said, you are going to travel to Istanbul, Damascus, and Jerusalem in 1898. So befriend the Sultan Caliph. We have to do it with him, befriend the Ottomans. And then we turn jointly against the traditional Western powers in the Middle East. So he worked it out in detail, how to do this, how to do that, and to develop an Afro-Asian jihad. And this was unique. First, they had to change the doctrine of jihad, because usually it's not allowed to fight with infidels against infidels. But this is exactly what they did. They changed the doctrine of jihad, that it was possible to wage jihad in a coalition war against other infidels on the side of Christians, theoretically also infidels. So this was the step number one, and the step number two was actually to call for jihad at the beginning of World War One. And to establish a news organization, as they called it, with 75 reading halls, they said it, reading halls, in centers of cities easily accessible with propaganda, jihad propaganda, and how World War One went on, and so on. So, and they used all means, publications, drawings, maps, and displayed them in those reading halls. And we found documents. One visitor was Gustav Stresemann in Istanbul. He visited two of those reading halls, and Stresemann concluded, well, that's really good. The Turks like it. The Ottomans like it. And it's not obvious that behind those reading halls is a German organization.
Mm-hmm. So these plans don't go particularly well during World War One. Could you talk a little bit about what happened?
Well, in 1915, they got a lot of jihad fatwas from Iran to the Middle East and to Turkey. And the military part or the military side went not so well for the Allied forces, that is the Ottomans and the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
An idea was born, how to use Islam and to develop it into a political doctrine, into an ideology. And this part of the joint effort survived World War One. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just that the war was not so successful that everyone stopped in this dealing. It went on mm-hmm. in the 1920s, in the 1930s.
Yes. Yeah, but what yeah. I meant was, is that the jihad that Oppenheim and the Germans were hoping to foment in the Middle East did not, in fact, take place. Or if it did take place, it was unsuccessful. They did not remove the British and the French.
Yes, it was in a way unsuccessful that the revolts, the planned or hoped for revolts, didn't occur during the war, but they occurred after the war.
Mm-hmm.
After the war, the Middle East was quite in a shaky situation, and there were revolts in Iraq and in Iran and Algeria. Little revolts, but they happened, and it was it had a long-lasting effect
mm-hmm.
Until the late 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
So an idea was born, and the idea to jihadize Islam went on.
Mm-hmm.
It was taken over by locals. They took over what they thought would fit them
mm-hmm.
In their effort to get rid of the Western powers in the Middle East and their value system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Before we talk about that continuity and we introduce who really the person who is really the sort of main character in the book, and that is Amin al-Husseini. The other thread that goes throughout Nazis, Islamists, and the making of the modern Middle East is anti-Semitism. At what point, that is prior to, let's say, 1922 or 21, was this Islamism and jihadization bound up with anti-Semitism?
You know, the term anti-Semitism is not such a lucky one because it implies that there are tribes of Semites. There weren't tribes of Semites per se, at least not in modern times. These are biblical terms. So there was quite a tradition of Jew hatred established way before, and it was connected to the advent of Islam and some problems within the first communities and hostilities between the first communities of Islam and the Jewish tribes available on the Arabian Peninsula. So this was, as I call it, a tribal tradition. And then in the modern age of nationalism and nation building, it developed and it was taken over by Hitler and his fellows. And on the other hand, in the Middle East, after 1918, many of former Arab Ottoman officers grew to leaders in Arab lands. They used the newly discovered weapon Islamism as well. And they themselves asked Hitler's Berlin for joint actions against the old foes. Or against the minorities. Remember, during World War I, both Hitler as a young soldier and Amin al-Husseini as a young Ottoman officer, they watched what went on with the Armenians, the Armenian genocide. And then there was an attempted genocide against the Jews of Palestine. And one of those officers became the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, al-Husseini, in 1921.
Well, let's actually turn to him. Can you tell us about Amin al-Husseini? Where does he come from and so on?
Yes, he was born into a very old and famous family. They moved to the area around Jerusalem, and Jerusalem itself since the 1500s. This is at least what he claimed in his autobiography. And then he became the Grand Mufti and acquired some key positions in 1921. And he was primarily a Jew hater right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. He didn't like them. One of the documents described him, it was his goal of his life to get rid of Jews in Arabian countries, in Arab countries. So he acquired the old tradition, and he developed it further into a political doctrine. And since he was also the head of the Muslim World Congress, in the early 1930s, used this concept. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is in danger because of the Jews. They like to rebuild their temple there and so on. This was one of his slogans, to universalize this approach and to put the Jews into the center and to develop Jew hatred and as a common denominator.
Before we go on with that theme and we find out how Amin al-Husseini becomes really an ally of Hitler's, tell us two things. One is the caliphate. We know that it disappears or is abandoned by the Turks after the war, and then the position of Grand Mufti. So first of all, what is the caliphate, and what does its disappearance signify? And the second question is, what is the Grand Mufti exactly?
The caliphate, as we know it in that time, survived about 500 years under the Ottomans, and it was the most important unifier of all Muslims in different countries. But as the Turks, especially under Kemal Atatürk, wanted to develop a nation state, they abolished first the Sultanate 1922, and in 2 years later, 1924, the caliphate. So for the first time in history, there was no more overarching umbrella to unite all Muslims. Mm-hmm. And therefore was also the Islamism very important to remember all of them, that there is a common cause to be used in different countries and overarching, not to go with the trend of nation states. So the Islamism was an overarching concept, not to have a nation state, but to stay together as a common ummah, as a common unity. So the caliphate was abolished, and there was nobody anymore to call for jihad for all of them. There are a lot of discussions how important it was, and some argue that it was not a real caliph, Sultan Caliph, the Ottoman one, because he only an Arab can be in such a position. But he was fairly recognized as the most important Muslim leader. Mm-hmm. Then after this, there was a lacuna, you know, that nothing is there anymore to build a Muslim bloc or an Islamic bloc in the world. So they had to turn to different countries to set up accesses and so on. And this is what happened with Amin al-Husseini. Your second question?
Mm-hmm.
What was your second
question? My second question was, what is the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem in this case? What is a Grand Mufti?
Well, the Grand Mufti is a an Islamic leader, a knowledgeable person who usually issues fatwas. These are Islamic texts on disputed questions, and he would be the authority to do so. And there was a system of muftis, regional muftis or local muftis, and there was a system of grand muftis, well established, let's say, since 200 years. And since now the Arab countries became independent, there were 36 of follower states after the Ottoman Empire went down. They had to establish their own system of muftis and grand muftis. Mm-hmm. And since Jerusalem was such an important point with the Al-Aqsa Mosque and so on, the grand mufti of Jerusalem was a very important person. And he might have been considered by the British as the one who can be addressed not only in religious matters or questions, but also in national matters, speaking for the people living in the area. Mm-hmm. The people living in the area called themselves Syrians, southern Syrians. Only later, let's say, starting with the 1930s, they called themselves as Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he called himself as the Grand Mufti of Palestine, Al Mufti Al Akbar min Filastin.
Mm-hmm.
And this was also, you know, from his side, a quest to be more important and to be a representative of a national cause and of a country. Mm-hmm. So it changed. He changed his position also from a religious leader to a political leader, to a leader of a political movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went on and incited his people to wage war against the British especially. And so they started revolts in 1936 to 1938. And he was heavily involved in the preparation and ongoing of this revolt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he became a partner, an interesting figure for the Nazis in Berlin as well, especially for Hitler. They watched what was going on in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. How did they first make contact with al-Husseini?
The first contact made al-Husseini on his part. He had... Mm-hmm. Living in Europe, in Geneva, Shakib Arslan, for instance, and they established a little community in Berlin with a mosque inaugurated in 1927, and the so-called Islam Institute. And these people in the Islam Institute, mainly students who were supposed to live there and to study there and to return to their countries, like Syria, they had close contacts to the Mufti. He had already established in Berlin different local bases, and so he was quite faster than the Nazis were. Later, the Nazis, they came to power in 1933, discovered the potential of the Islamists, and they thought they are like-minded, both movements. So, and from the Islam Institute, 1927 in Berlin, it became to the Central Islam Institute, and the Mufti became a figurehead of this institute and was a gathering point for many people in Germany, especially Islamists and Muslims.
Mm-hmm. At what point does, and I think this happens, al-Husseini go on the German payroll?
In 1937, and already in 1936, the Germans contacted the Mufti, and he was involved in an anti-British revolt. And he suggested to be supported by weapon deliveries. The Saudis were involved too, and so the Germans sent to support al-Husseini's revolts against the British weapons to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And then from there it goes on, and a year later, 1937, he developed a plan. And the main points were, in exchange for support for the national cause, the national Palestinian cause, he would propagate Nazism in the Middle East, and in exchange for this he would get a national home, and he insisted on destroying the national Jewish home in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. But what did it mean to destroy the national Jewish home? You can't destroy the infrastructure, you wouldn't destroy the houses. It always was a cover-up to destroy the people in reality. Mm-hmm. So this was established in 1937, and in the mid of that year, he called on all Muslims in the world to rid themselves of Jews. Mm-hmm. He was even faster than Hitler. Mm-hmm. Hitler did it later, a couple of years later. Mm-hmm. But he knew Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, and he knew that what Hitler's program involved and the destruction of the Jews in three stages, in Europe, in the Middle East, and globally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, when does al-Husseini first, I guess he only meets Hitler once, and that's in November of 1941? And that's
yes.
A particularly significant meeting. I mean, I've read the documents, some of them are in your book, that describe this meeting between the Grand Mufti and Hitler. They are chilling documents, to be sure. We have minutes of them, and as I say, they are and there's an agenda. So maybe you could talk a little bit about this meeting in November of 1941.
Yes, this was the 28th of November 1941, as Hitler received al-Husseini. 3 months before, al-Husseini was still in the Middle East. He was he instigated the Farhud pogrom in Baghdad, as about 200 Jews died. So, and then he asked Hitler to be received by him in Berlin, and Hitler said yes. And from there on, a clock was ticking, because there was still the possibility for legal Jewish travel to the Middle East. And al-Husseini asked Hitler different times to stop any legal Jewish emigration to the Middle East. And Hitler knew what al-Husseini wanted, but he couldn't receive him without stopping this Jewish traveling to the Middle East. So shortly before Hitler received al-Husseini, he ordered to stop any Jewish legal emigration. And then that night, in 1.5 hours, both talked about their plans. And Hitler told the Mufti that he is in an uncompromising war against the Jews. And this would include destruction of the Jewish national home in Palestine. And as Hitler said, the destructive influence of Jewish interests in the Middle East in general. So Hitler promised al-Husseini to liquidate not only the Jewish home, but the Jews in the Middle East, as soon as his armies would conquer the Middle East. On the one side, by Rommel in North Africa, Egypt, to Syria and Palestine, and on the other side, via the Caucasus Mountains, to Iran and Iraq, and further on to India. This concept was called a pincer's grip.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he promised, and he said to the Mufti, basically, you are the man to lead the Arab affairs and to set up a Jew-free Arab empire in the Middle East. And this was the very wish of the Mufti to be the leader of such an empire.
Mm-hmm. The next day, I don't know whether it's by chance or not. We'll talk about that in a second. I believe there's the order for the Wannsee Conference to meet.
Yes.
First, it was going to meet in December, and then it was pushed back to, I think, January of the next of 1942. There's been some debate about this and about your book concerning the relationship between al-Husseini and the there's no Führerbefehl, but the order of Hitler to actually exterminate all the Jews of Europe and really the world. Can you talk a little bit about that? What relationship this had? How this factored into Hitler's thinking?
Yes. Again, we are on November 28, 1941. That afternoon in Berlin, the Mufti was received with military honor guards and music and all of this. They met Hitler and al-Husseini, and they talked about their plans. And they concluded what I call a pact of genocide. Hitler said for the first time and quite openly that he wanted to destroy the Jews in Europe and in the Middle East. And later that night, as Mufti left, Hitler gave four orders. And then there was a fifth decision. And this fifth decision was only given orally, but we can trace it back according to the documents, and this was Hitler ordered to prepare for the Holocaust. And either that night or the next morning, the invitations went out to 13 senior Nazis for the Wannsee Conference to organize the logistics of mass murder. And to blur all of this, Hitler only got out the news of his reception with al-Husseini 10 days later.
Mm.
And 10 days later, it became known to the world that Hitler met al-Husseini. And but as they published their meeting, they published it without a date.
Mm-hmm.
They simply said the Führer Hitler received al-Husseini without any date, and saying some sentences, you know, you can't say much about it, what was the contents of their talk. So there was a clear awareness by Hitler that very night or the next morning, the process of the Wannsee Conference was started.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
After he spoke to al-Husseini, after he unveiled his plans completely openly that he liked to destroy all the Jews.
Mm-hmm. I want to be very clear about what you're arguing here and what you're not arguing. You're not arguing that al-Husseini convinced Hitler to launch the final solution of the Jewish question.
No.
Yes.
This
okay.
is impossible
yeah.
for one reason. Hitler had already the idea in 1925 in his book, and he published it, and there he said gassing of Jews and the destruction of what he calls the Judeo-Communist Empire. So Hitler propagated since 1920, basically, but most openly since 1925, his goals for the destruction of the left empire, and for, this was an ideological point and a racist point, the destruction of the Jews and the Slavs also.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the Mufti learned it.
Mm-hmm.
He had a network of people in Europe, and they told him what was going on, what were Hitler's goals. And so he was fast in learning what the real goals were, and they developed in parallel. And then they converged. They had common interests. The interest of the Mufti was to keep the Jews out of the Middle East or to drive them out. And Hitler's goal was to destroy the Jews. And the Mufti wanted nothing more than that Hitler stops any legal Jewish emigration or illegal Jewish emigration to the Middle East, not get a Jewish home there.
And essentially then this gave the German Jews no place to go.
Right. He closed all possible doors of traveling to the Middle East. And he insists on this.
So al-Husseini's work or observation or, I'm not quite sure, cooperation with the Nazis is not done at that point. He spends much of the war in Germany, is that right?
Yes, 4.5 years, and he had access to all the leading Nazis, and he established, or he managed to establish a personal relationship to Himmler, to Eichmann, and to Goebbels, the propaganda minister, and to Goering, this was a Luftwaffe chief, and so on.
So
all of he established personal relationships, and he lobbied them to do this and that in his favor.
And you asked the question, I know that you ask it in an article, and you also talk about it here. What did al-Husseini know about the Holocaust and the logistics of the Holocaust as it was unfolding in 1942, really, the industrial killing begins? What does he know, and how does he know it?
First of all, Hitler, half a year before in this famous meeting in, at the end of November, Hitler had explained his goals to him quite openly to destroy him. And then shortly thereafter, in December, Eichmann met the Mufti in his map room and explained to him how to solve, in quotation marks, how to solve the Jewish question. And there we have reports about this. And the reports say that the Mufti was very impressed how Eichmann planned all of this, and it concerned 11 million Jews at the beginning in Europe, including in Europe, the Turkish parts of Europe, and so on. There were quite detailed lists of which country, how many Jews, and so on. So he got first-hand information what was going on. And then the day after the Wannsee conference, where the Holocaust logistics were managed, right the day after the Wannsee conference on 20th January 1942, the Mufti was received by Fritz Grobba, and Grobba told him what went on at the Wannsee conference. So he had quite good knowledge what were the plans and how they carried them out. And the Mufti said once in his memoirs, I was privy of this information, and rightly so, because I was the leader of revolts in the Middle East against the other powers, so I have a right to know. And he acted really as a watchdog, and he traveled to the towns, let's say Budapest, where the Nazis would round up Jews, and he, in a way, he controlled it, or he watched it. And yearly, they would meet Himmler, Heinrich Himmler, the SS leader, and al-Husseini, and with all these leading guys who were busy with rounding up Jews. And they talked about their experiences, and at one point in mid-1943, Himmler and al-Husseini met in close to Ukraine in the headquarters of Himmler, SS headquarters, and Himmler told him of having killed so far 3 million Jews. And he said, and al-Husseini, in his memoirs that were published only in 1999 in Arabic, he said it. I can quote it. He said, "Hat فقد أبدنا حتى الآن حوالي ثلاثة ملايين منهم. We have killed so far 3 million of them, meaning Jews." So he quite clearly. He knew what was going on. He watched it, and he had a lot of meetings with leading figures, with leading Nazi figures.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think one of the contentions you make is he's very interested in the logistics of it because he plans to put them into practice after the Nazis win the war.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes. Please say the question again.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the things that you say is that he was very interested in the logistics of the genocide because he was going to seek German help and put this German plan into effect in Palestine and in the Middle East generally.
Right. We found interrogation protocols by the Soviets. They interrogated the main Nazi diplomat, Fritz Grobber, 1 year after the war's end. And he said quite frankly, yes, Hitler and Ribbentrop, the German foreign ministers, planned to evacuate the Jews of Palestine and the Middle East to kill them. So it was quite clear. And al-Husseini never thought that he would spend 4.5 years in Germany, in Berlin. They always expected that first the Nazis would win, he would return to Jerusalem, and he already asked Himmler to get an assistant how to manage this process to get rid of the Jews in the Middle East. So for him it was a learning curve or a learning process how the Nazis did it, and he plans the same in the Middle East. It's quite clear.
Let's move forward just a little bit. The Nazis lose the war, but al-Husseini's efforts, let's put it that way, do not cease. And he enlists more Germans.
So, no. Yeah. Already in 1944, they started the war after the war. Hitler agreed to al-Husseini's suggestions to send troops, paratroopers, Palestinian paratroopers to Palestine to fight the Jews there. They already, 1 year before the war's end, they started the next war. And al-Husseini was a recognized leader. He returned a year later in 1946 to the Middle East. And there he organized resistance against the Jewish presence in the Middle East. And he was basically the organizer of the so-called Nakba, the debacle, the Palestinian debacle. He prepared everything. He got together the weapons, the soldiers, and so on. But he was not successful, as we know.
And one of the things that you mentioned in the book that, that I found very interesting is that he enlists a lot of former Nazis.
Yes. Now the page was turned in the Middle East, and Europeans persecuted the Nazis, and they fled to the Middle East. It was quite an interesting option. What's going to be after the war? And so they al-Husseini organized asylums for former Nazis, ex-Nazis, mainly in Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Algeria. So there are estimates, conservative estimates, about 4,000 Nazis who settled down in Middle Eastern countries. And there are other estimates about 7,000 to 8,000. For instance, Simon Wiesenthal thought that about 8,000 ex-Nazis settled down in the Middle East. Sometimes they often they changed names and got Islamic names, and it was not easy to trace them. So. And many of them worked in propaganda, Jew hatred, anti-liberal ideas, and the outcome is quite known. It never ceased in the Middle East. And Middle East is one of the regions, was one of the world regions where the supporters of the Nazis often stayed in power or gained power after World War II, whereas in Europe and America, the ideology of Nazism was delegitimized. This process didn't happen in the Middle East. We have a lot, and as we found out, we have a lot of people in the Middle East who remained in power or gained power in the revolts after World War II. Let me look up here. Usually, those people were born between 1917 and 1942, and they were heavily swayed by Rome and Berlin. And I just named some people who displayed the influence on them, either in their texts or in their memoirs. Let me name a few names. Al-Habib al-Bourguiba, Ahmed Ben Bella in North Africa, Muammar al-Qaddafi, Yasser Arafat, Mahmoud Abbas, Abdel Nasser, Anwar Sadat, and the founders of the Ba'ath Party in Syria and Iraq, Michel Aflaq, Salah ad-Din Bitar, Hafez al-Assad, Saddam Hussein, and then the clerics and royals in the Middle East. For instance, in Iran, like the Ayatollahs al-Kashani and al-Khomeini, they were influenced by Berlin and Rome, of course. And they either gained power or they stayed in power. And so this region had a special problem with Nazism and Islamism.
Before we move on to this next phase, I want to talk a little bit about 1947 and 1948. In the book, you point out that al-Husseini and the Palestinians, or I don't know, maybe the Islamists or Arabs, missed a great opportunity in 1947-48 because there was a UN-sponsored partition plan that they refused.
Yes, they refused many proposals likewise. And 13 Arab countries refused this partition plan. And nowadays, by the way, they recognized the missed chance they had 1947, 1948 to gain a little foothold and Palestinian part of that country. So, but al-Husseini was so convinced all the years that the Nazi option would be the right one of the Middle East, he had really a habit of refusing any ideas and even good ideas that would have worked for the Palestinian side in 1937, for instance, to stop the Jewish immigration within the next 10 years and to have a basically Palestinian country there. And so he was really unrealistic, and this unrealistic tendency lingered on all the years in the Middle East.
I was going to say this is another one of the themes that comes up in the book, and I don't quite know how to describe it, but it's as if al-Husseini can't think past this sort of all or nothing alternative.
Yes, exactly. And this was a line. And for instance, we display a document in the book, and he organized in 1953 an Islamic Congress for the Palestinian cause, as he said. And there are 6 points. I just read the first four of them. All Muslims must work for the liberation of Palestine. The liberation of Palestine meant destroying Israel and getting the Jews out of the Middle East. Number two, Israeli occupation of Palestine is invalid, and Israel's displacement of the Palestinian Arabs of their rights is an aggression against every Muslim. Consideration, point three, of peace with Israel or dealing with Israel is treason. And number four, the proposed internationalization of Jerusalem is a conspiracy against the Muslim world. Even the proposed internationalization in which he would get a foothold, he refused even this. He said consideration of peace with Israel or dealing with Israel is treason. And we know that we know it by family members even, he was behind murdering of people who had a tendency to accommodate with Israel in a kind of moderation.
So it's about at this time that we see a sea change in Arab politics, and Islamism becomes it sort of goes out of favor, and we see Arab nationalism come into favor. How does al-Husseini adapt to the Arab nationalists in the 1950s?
He had not such a good life in the 1950s because all these nationalists came to power, like Abdel Nasser in Egypt and in Syria and Iraq. So he concentrated on developing further the cause of Islamism on with the World Muslim Congress. Every year, almost every year in Pakistan and other countries, he would organize meetings of the World Muslim Congress, number one. And number two, he focused on Western Europe. The Muslim Brothers were persecuted by these nationalists in the Middle East who gained power. So he organized asylum for them in Western Europe, and what I call the hideouts of the Muslim Brotherhoods and other Islamists. They settled down in Geneva, and his man in Geneva was Saeed Ramadan, as it was the case before this with Shakib Arslan, and they promoted and organized meetings, mosque building, and all of this in the 1950s and in the 1960s. So, and from there, as we know, goes the path to 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
The Hamburg cell and in other towns, there they hatched all these plans for 9/11, and there they worked for the destruction of the enemy behind the enemy. To disturb the enemy behind the enemy is an old concept, also connected to Oppenheim. What he did was to disturb the great powers within their colonies. And now the concept was to fight the enemy behind the enemy. And as you know, they regarded Israel as a little Satan and America as a big Satan.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they worked for this. And al-Husseini, as long as he lived until 1974, did fundraising for them and supported them in any way possible.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things you say in the book, or claims you make, is that al-Husseini, while he was not successful in his policy in the Middle East, he did succeed in carrying over, so to say, the Islamists over this nationalist period so that they could reemerge in the 70s.
Yes, and you know, it was quite clear. There was a process of decolonization, and in the process of decolonization, nation building and nation is very important. But nation and nation building is only one element of the identity. The most important element, even for the nationalists, was their Muslim
mm-hmm.
identity. And so we see in the 1970s and 1980s, many so-called nationalists became all of a sudden Islamists. They returned to their basic identity. For instance, Saddam Hussein had no problem to display himself as an Islamist, supporting Islamist cases in Palestine, for instance. Or even Abdel Nasser, who was a strong nationalist, became in the late 1960s a kind of supporter of Islamists, as his successor did, Anwar Sadat. He freed all the Islamists in Egyptian prisons, and so it became again a powerful tendency within Egypt first and other countries, surrounding countries, and then throughout the 1980s and into the global era.
Yeah. So, a second claim, that is the first claim being they carried over, or he helped carry over Islamism through this nationalist period, is that he has a direct effect on what we might call the Arafat era.
Yes, very much so. Arafat, he worked together with Arafat since the 1950s, basically. But Arafat was a little-known figure in the 1950s. He participated in the fight against Israel. And then in 1957, he set up his basic organization in Kuwait, Fatah. And afterwards, he met occasionally the Grand Mufti and got advice from him. And in 1968, at the end of 1968, they met after the lost war of 1967. And al-Husseini advised Arafat to set up an organization and to take over the PLO. The PLO was established in 1965. and now we are 4 years later after lost war. And so al-Husseini developed the concept to reconquer parts of Palestine by Fatah units and in an armed struggle. And he advised Arafat to take over the PLO and to develop a plan, how to do it, what are the main points. And Arafat did. Mm-hmm. And he succeeded in taking over the PLO in the next year, 1969. So basically, we can consider Arafat as al-Husseini's heir. Mm-hmm. Al-Husseini's heir for the Middle East or in the center of the Middle East, as Saeed Ramadan was his heir in Western Europe.
And I don't think it does any damage to the historical record to say that Arafat also inherited this all-or-nothing mentality.
Yes, unfortunately. Unfortunately, against other advices,
yes,
even from his friends, mm-hmm, they said, why don't you do this compromise and get a little platform, and from there you develop further. But the concept of moderation or rethinking, you know, and the possibility for the Palestinians to freely choose their leaders was simply not given. Basically, more than 60 years, the Palestinians were under the leadership of either al-Husseini or Arafat. And there was no good possibility for them to have a competition, to look for smart other leaders who would do this or would gain help by others in the international community. But was not possible.
Yeah. Well, many of Arafat's critics used to say, I don't know if they say it anymore, that Arafat never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity.
Yes, I know. This.
Yeah, and also he couldn't take yes for an answer.
Yes.
One of the things said of Arafat.
Very true, so.
I want to kind of close our interview by asking you a question. We already discussed it a little bit on email, and that is just a couple of days ago I was listening to the BBC, and they were interviewing quite a moderate I don't know what to call him. He's a Muslim scholar and someone who is Muslim and from the Middle East. And a caller asked the question about al-Husseini and the Nazis. And this fellow, who I'm sure is very well-meaning and actually does nice things, categorically denied that there was any relationship between al-Husseini and the Nazis. Why do people do this? I mean,
well, it's really difficult. You know, we started now a process of re-evaluating by acquiring new records. Only now, only after the German unification, only after American laws, the Nazi Wartime Disclosure Act, for instance, only now we are able to access the records. Mm-hmm. And only now there begins a process of puzzling all these documents from all sides involved together.
Mm-hmm.
And therewith only comes new knowledge, new insights, and we look forward for new discussions.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite late, but it's ongoing, and we expect much more to come.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. So, Wolfgang, let me ask you our traditional final question on new books in history, in this case. What are you working on now?
I'm working now on a biography about Amin al-Husseini, mm-hmm, that focuses on his last quarter century after World War II until 1974. And we got new documents from all sides, as I said, although it's still difficult. Some archives are still closed. Some collections are inaccessible for various reasons. And so I'm looking forward to my first draft of biography.
Well, I wish you luck on that book. And let me say thank you very much for being on the show today. We've been talking with Wolfgang G. Schwanitz about his book, Nazis, Islamists, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. I highly recommend people go buy it. It's a really eye-opening book. Thank you, Wolfgang.
You're welcome.
And let me tell everybody who listens to this podcast, thank you for listening. We really appreciate your support, and I hope everybody has a good week.